have about 20 minutes for each presentation and then some time for questions after each presentation. So please go ahead. Thank you.
I'll sort of stand up, yeah. Hi, everybody, and thank you for being here. And thank you, Nicolina, for inviting us in Amsterdam and sort of introducing me to this space here. When Nicolene asked me to read Anarchism, I was just kind of a bit confused. What does that reading mean? And I thought, oh, does it mean actually? Emma Goldman's Was My Life Worth Living, which I chose to do, or was it like I could sort of interpret it in various ways? And I'm a lawyer, I teach law, I teach criminal law at Birkbeck College, but a few years ago I was finishing a book on law ethics and politics based on a philosopher's work called Judith Butler, and I was thinking of where to take that project or what to think next, and I was thinking of violence, and then the question of violence I found it in itself too limited and too problematic in rethinking of the world. So Nicolene's sister actually suggested to me to read Emma Goldman, and I bought Living My Life, her biography, and 6 years onwards, I'm still working with Emma Goldman and trying and think of how Emma Goldman's work, and that's kind of my preoccupation, and her life provides us a different spectrum of living where law is not necessary, right? I'm a lawyer, and I think law is one of the most limiting apparatuses that we have in creating our lives, and Emma Goldman for me has been an inspiration. So I chose Was My Life Worth Living? It's one of her last pieces of writings, and the editors of Harper's Magazine asked her to write this piece when she returned in the US in 1934 about, well, to give a tour, and I'll talk a little bit about the tour in a second. What I will be reading, doing is a paragraph maybe from what was my life worth living, and then interpreting it. So I'm going to start by reading the editors of Harper's Magazine invitation and the way they set up this Emma Goldman. The editors write, "It is strange that it is strange what time does to political causes. A generation ago, it seemed to many American conservatives as if the opinions which Emma Goldman was expressing might sweep the world. Now she fights almost alone for what seems to be a lost cause. Contemporary radicals are overwhelmingly opposed to her. More than that, her devotion to liberty and her detestation of government interference might be regarded as placing her anomalously in the same part of the political spectrum as the gentlemen of the Liberty League." And the Liberty League was a Republican men that were opposing actually Roosevelt's, because 1934, they were opposing Roosevelt's New Deal. So the editors seem to that they find affinities in Emma Goldman's ideas to this Liberty League. But what they find yet surprising after reading her article is yet, they say, in this article, which might be regarded as her last will and statement, she sticks to her guns. Needless to say, her opinions are not ours. We offer them as an exhibit of valiant consistency, of really rugged individualism, and unaltered by opposition or by advancing age. So they're surprised by Emma Goldman's piece because they do find a consistency with her ideas, even at this late stage of her life, which is 65, I think, in 1934. In 1934, three lawyers appealed to the Board of Nationalization to allow Emma Goldman to return back to the U.S. In 1917, some of you probably know this stuff better than I do. In 1917... she was exiled from the U.S. because of her anti-conscription activities. The US was entering into the First World War late, and Emma Goldman and a lot of other anarchist associates, including Alexander Bergman, organized a series of lectures where they were trying to give information to young men that they would be compulsory conscribed to make decision whether they wanted to be drafted into the army or not. They were arrested. Both her and Alexander Bergman were arrested, put on trial, found guilty, and exiled in 1917. So her return was quite controversial, right? Her return back was quite controversial because she was this kind of figure that was feared in the US. So it took three lawyers to convince the naturalization the naturalization board to let her in, and only for specific reasons to tour the US and do a tour her book, her biography, Living My Life, which was finished by then, and talk about theater and literature. That was kind of the conditions on her visit, and visit friends, of course, but not to make any political statements, right? So that was the conditions of the visit, and she did. She was allowed to visit the US for 90 days. But despite the fact that the editors say that, you know, she was this kind of old, frail woman, she wouldn't kind of pose any threat to the US anymore. It's kind of interesting. In the archive in the Institute of Social History in Amsterdam, we find a letter. You can go there and look it up. You find a letter where a group of women write to Eleanor Roosevelt, the president's wife, with concerns about Emma Goldman's visit in the US. They're kind of really, really concerned because they're afraid that she might assassinate the president. And I'll read you, she's 65, and I'll read you a little, could I find it? Yeah. Where is it? This is how Eleanor Roosevelt responds back to this kind of group of ladies that were concerned. It says, "Do not worry. He is very carefully protected, and in any case, Emma Goldman is now a very old woman. I really think that this country can stand the shock of her presence for 90 days." You know, that's how she responds. You know, we're not terrified anymore of her. That's kind of the context in which this essay is being written. And you can find, if you're interested in Emma Goldman, and you can find a really 3 or 4 minutes video clip on YouTube. It's from a documentary called Anarchism in America, and it's the only actually video film we have of Emma Goldman, where she gives, on arrival to the US in 1934, she gives a set of interviews to journalists. And there's some, you know, one of the questions that she's been asked is, let me try and remember it. What do you think of Hitler, Miss Goldman? I never met him, and I don't want to. You know, kind of, she's got kind of a very acerbic style of answering questions. Also, you can find out by reading kind of secondary literature, she hated television and the moving image. She preferred theatre, etc., because she found it much more interactive. Okay. So was Emma Goldman's life worth living? Well, in this wonderful little essay that you can find on the Anarchist Archive, isn't it, Nicolina?
It's
Yeah. You can download it and or read it online, whatever. It's a really, really lovely essay where she kind of looks back on her life, and the couple of essays, also previous ones, older ones, where she likes the idea of looking back into her life and asking the question whether I would relieve myself again as an anarchist. You know, was my life worth living? And you might guess that her answer was Yes, but in kind of taking us to her answer, she tries to answer a couple of questions. What was her life made of, and why was it worth living? And one of the questions, she starts this essay, and I'm going to read a little bit because I think I love the start of this essay, so I'd like to kind of it. And I'll try and do it slowly because you don't have the text and you cannot read along with me. In yesterday at the New Amsterdam art space, the booklet, so we all read along, but they ran out of booklets, so so we couldn't bring anything here. So she starts, the essay starts in this way, almost starts in this way. How much a personal philosophy is a matter of temperament and how much it results from experience is a moot question. Naturally, we arrive at conclusions in the light of our experience through the application of the process we call reasoning to the facts observed in the events of our lives. The child, she says, is susceptible to fantasy. At the same time, he sees life more truly in some respects than his elders do as he becomes conscious of his surroundings. He has not yet become absorbed by the customs and prejudices which make up the largest part of what passes of thinking. Each child responds differently to his environment. Some become rebels, refusing to be dazzled by social superstitions. They are outraged by every injustice perpetrated upon them or upon others. They grow ever more sensitive to the suffering around them and the restriction registering every convention and taboo imposed upon them. I evidently belong to the first category. Since my earliest recollection of my youth in Russia, I have rebelled against orthodoxy in every form. I could never bear witness to harshness. I could never bear to witness harshness, whether I was outraged over the official brutality practiced on the peasants in our neighborhood. I wept bitter tears when young men were conscribed into the army and torn from homes and hearths. I resented the treatment of our servants, who did the hardest work and yet had to put up with wretched sleeping quarters and the living of our table. I was indignant when I discovered that love between young people of Jewish and Gentile origin was considered the crime of crimes and the birth of an illegitimate child the most deprived immorality. In reading this kind of two first, and what I tend to do in reading Emma Goldman is to try and think about her, as I'm teaching law, but I'm also teaching, I work with political philosophy and theories, to think how we can translate what she tells us about certain things into a contemporary kind of context and use her thoughts in a critical way. So in reading these two paragraphs, it seems to me, or it appears to me, that Emma Goldman gives us some really valuable information as to how a rebel is made up, okay? What constitutes a rebel? What constitutes a disobedience? And she draws this rebel or this disobedient herself as somebody that is able to have fantasy, right? To have fantasy like a child has fantasy. It's as somebody that refuses to be put down by social and other conventions. It's somebody that really senses injustice, not injustice also about themselves, but injustice that takes place in relation to others. It's somebody that really deeply feel and is able to see in this way by feeling, by having a fantasy about the world and how the world could be, is able to kind of move on and rebel against society. So you have to have kind of certain like a child, kind of on by the, untouched by the conventions, untouched about from prejudicial statements, and he'd be able to work through them in order to create a different world. And it's kind of interesting because this is very, 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 for me as somebody that kind of works with political theory or within legal theory, it's a very, very different imaginary than the one that traditional political theories will be working or trying to imagine what is disobedience or what is how, where does disobedience stems from. And the most kind of sided political theory test around the concept of disobedience is one which is called On Civil Disobedience. This is in academia, so I teach. It's one by a philosopher or political theorist called Hannah Arendt, and it's called On Civil Disobedience, right? Published in 1972, who, of course, never read any of our anarchists, right? And, you know, it seems that she, you know, has a whole kind of liberal understanding of how does civil disobedience emerges. And she just describes it as when a plurality of people come together to contest the state, but to contest it when there is no other avenue to negotiate with the state. So civil disobedience arises when the state fails where the other avenues such as kind of parliament, etc., fails to listen to what people want or takes people to an unfair war. For her, that's kind of civil disobedience. This, what Emma Goldman kind of tells us, a disobedient having a subjective fantasy, feeling the injustice, feeling that the norms, social, cultural, legal norms, laws are not fair. It's not so much of interest to Hannah Arendt. Actually, she says any subjective understanding of how of civil disobedience is, she claims, is both individualistic and apolitical. Okay, and I personally find that problematic because it fails to understand that for anybody to be politicized, perhaps. It takes a lot of labor. It takes a lot of labor rejecting. Actually, there's a lot of labor to reject all the norms that one has come into. All right, and by not kind of taking the individual into account, which is what Emma Goldman seems to be focusing on. I'm not saying that people do not form associations or groups to disobey, but I'm saying that it takes a lot of individual labor for individuals to play with the system. And Emma Goldman seems to, by the figure of the child, seems to be suggesting that we need to be not afraid of the system, play with it as in the way that children play with toys, right? In order to recreate, how many minutes?
5 minutes.
Okay. Wow. All right, so that's what is a rebel. The other kind of questions that I'm kind of raising through this, and perhaps we can talk about them in question time, is the essay seems to me also provides us not only with some guidelines of what it means to be a rebel or what it takes to be a rebel, but also what type of ethics. What type of ethics, not in terms of morality, okay? What type of ethical relationships we form as Emma Goldman form as an anarchist, and how does one turn their life into an art of living? Because in my mind, Emma Goldman made herself into an art, right, and to critique the state, and she used a variety of methods. I don't know whether they were conscious or not, but they were worked over time to show the state how its powers would not stop her from continuing to dream. And I will end up with her last sentence, I think, which is...
The one thing I remembered about Emma Goldman was this phrase on the poster, if I can't dance,
I indeed, no, absolutely. So I'll end up with her last, if I can find it, her last paragraph, I think, and that's it. I brought the page today. No, I brought it. Yeah. I lost the last page yesterday. So was her life worth living? Her answer: I think my life and my work have been successful. Was it what is generally regarded as success, acquisition of wealth, the capture of power or social prestige, I consider the most dismal failures. I hold when it is said of a man that he has arrived, and it's a phrase that you hear very often still, that person has arrived. It means that he is finished. His development has stopped at that point. I have always striven to remain in a state of flux and continuous growth, and not to petrify in a niche of self-satisfaction. If I had my life to live over again, like everyone else, I should wish to alter minor details. But in any of my more important actions and attitudes, I will repeat my life as I have lived it. Certainly, I should work for anarchism with the same devotion and confidence in its ultimate triumph. Yeah, sure.
Because you make a difference between the way Hannah Arendt looks at about how what it is to be a rebel and the way Emma Goldman looks at it. From what you say, I understand that Emma Goldman keeps the being of a rebel and the idea of an imaginary.
Mm-hmm. Oh no, I didn't mean that at all. What I meant is that it doesn't just. I'm saying that it requires a lot of work, and it requires also the work of fantasy, right? It requires also one to be able to reject the social norms that. Finds oppressive, okay, and that is a form of action that brings people together later on and form associations. So it's not one. I'll give you an example. Hannah Arendt seems to be saying in that on civil disobedience that Thoreau, for example, who refused to pay his poll tax because of the injustices that he thought in that related to the poll tax, and he did it for because his consciousness wouldn't allow tax, and he got into prison. Consciousness is not a reason for civil disobedience. Well, why not? Because she says Hannah Arendt seems to say no, but if you do things on an individual level, you're apolitical. And I don't think you're apolitical if you do. If you're politicized because of your consciousness, then you're not apolitical. You're prompted into action because your conscience couldn't stand deep injustice. So it's not one or the other. What I'm trying to say is that it needs both. Yeah.
Uh-huh. They've been going on military bases. It's because group of the state made wrong kinds of law. This civil disobedient action with a big group.
Absolutely, yeah. Sure. Yeah, I agree. I'm saying individuals become groups. I'm not disagreeing. There are various reasons that prompt us all to do things, and we should never forget those as well. It's not, we just don't suddenly become political subjects, right? We feel an injustice, we, whatever it is, yeah. Yeah.
To become politicized, but I don't know if that's true.
Okay, sure. Yeah, we can question that. Yeah. That's. I would say that you kind of make your. I would agree with your account. You know what you said. I think is you can definitely say that we can read her in this way. But what I think is that we can all make ourselves these children, right? You know this child that can all. All kind of imagine, keep our imaginations alive and not having them flattened by laws, social morality, etc. I think that's how I understand also part of it. But yeah, you're right. You can read her in that way.
Because that would be like a bit negative.
It is. Yeah. You're right. You're right. It's. Well, maybe, I don't know. Is it truth? I don't know. You can also make, even if you were not stubborn as a child, as long as you kind of keep playing, I guess, and seeing different visions of the world and how it could possibly against this prescribed world of law. So she's writing in 1934 and she lived quite a bit of the late 19th century as well. So it kind of is a different world, I guess, that she's also describing as well. Because stubborn children, yeah.
Yeah, I think it is also because in that time, in the 30s, there was the nature-nurture debate,
yeah,
I call it.
Yeah.
So that is why...
It's coming from there.
Yeah, I think
okay.
So.
Yeah.
And of course, okay, yeah.
Uh-huh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, absolutely.
Thank you, Elena. We
thank you.
To round it up. Thank
yeah.
You for, but
thank
we'll
you.
Be here for the rest of
yeah,
the
yeah.
So next up is Catherine Boehm. Do you want to have this one? You're okay. All right.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me. Air some ideas today. I'm an artist. In my role as an artist, I will not even pretend to be an academic or a theorist or anything. When Nico read in this reading Anarchism session, I wanted to read Colin Ward, whose books, those two particular books, weren't in the archive, so we added them. There are two books. One is called The Child in the City, published in 1978, and one, The Child in the Country. Do you know Colin Ward? I give up. He's British, born in 1924, and he died 3 years ago. And in Britain, he's a very central figure. He's really remembered as one of the most famous anarchists for the last half century. And a lot of people, after his death, described him as a pioneer of mutualism. And a few biographical facts. He was an editor of the British anarchist newspaper Freedom from 1947 to 1960, and a founder and editor of the anarchist journal Anarchy from 1961 to 1970. He trained as an architect and worked as an architect from 52 to 61, and later as an education officer and planner for a London borough. In his book, Anarchy in Action, from 1973, he set out his belief that an anarchist society was not an end goal, and Colin saw all distant goals as a form of tyranny and believed that anarchist principles could be discerned in everyday human relations and impulses. And within this perspective, politics was about strengthening cooperative relations and supporting human ingenuity in its everyday forms. I just read one more paragraph here. His kind of anarchism was therefore far from being a speculative vision of a future society, and it was more a description of a mode of human organization rooted very much in the experience of everyday life and which operates side by side with and in spite of the dominant authoritarian trends of our society. Colin Ward is important in a kind of architectural context because of his writing. He wrote a lot of essays and he gave a lot of talks, and I think that's how he's mainly remembered, on new planning rules. He did a lot of research into rural overpopulation, into how planning is structured, and made very strong demands for a self-organized planning system. It's a bit out of context now, because yesterday, the reasons why I had chosen those books is not that I wanted to talk about children in particular, but I wanted to talk about the fact that Colin Ward paid quite equal attention to the urban and the rural. And his research into housing, living conditions, educational conditions, always covered the rural context and the urban, which to me is quite remarkable. I work as an artist in a city. I'm part of this project that Nico mentioned earlier, My Villages. And My Villages is a small group, three of us. And we set out 10 years ago to ask why we actually never work in the village, not to mention our home village, why kind of the place for cultural production was always automatically assumed to be the city for most of us. So in that sense, Colin Ward is important for me as someone who pays equal attention and raises issues about both. Now, so to introduce him a bit more, those three books that I had yesterday, I just read a few chapters, so you get a rough idea of what he's concerned with. Chapters are called Alternatives in Architecture, The Future of the Design Profession, A Wonderful Place to Grow Up, Self-Help and Sustainability, The Anarchist House, Colonizing Small Spaces, that's in the Child in the City book, Players, Protest and Exploration, The City as Resource, and in the Child in the Country book, chapters include Images of Childhood, The Culture of the Bus, Trapped Teenagers, I think it's my favorite title, Trapped Teenagers, and Country Futures. So yesterday I was using those two books to talk about relationships between the urban and the rural, and mainly about preconceptions and prejudice that both sides bring when it comes to like thinking or entering the other. So this kind of ideas of dominance and arrogance, and that's not exclusive to the city. I think the rural can be quite arrogant about the city. It's also what I'm interested in is like to think about production and consumption in both consuming what. And I'm of course interested how in a professional role as an artist or architect I contribute to either context. And ultimately the clear split between the urban and the rural is impossible. But from my experience, discussions focus on either or. Either we talk about global cities or we talk about rural life, but rarely about the interrelations. So yesterday I was using both books to talk about things in relation. I'm reading you one quote from Colin Ward, maybe to give you a sense of his kind of language. And I think his language was a very practical one, and it was very much about motivating people to do things differently. So one sentence from the Talking to Architects book, the chapter on Alternatives in Architecture from 1976, reads as following. Most of the world's buildings are not the result of the work of the professional architect. Everywhere, people build for themselves. using such locally available material as were available to them. A decade ago, Bernard Rudofsky's exhibition, Architecture Without Architects, dazzled the visitors with its demonstration of the sheer perfection of the many forms vernacular buildings had developed all around the globe. Yet he told me last year, architecture leaves no room for the study of the unpedigreed, undated buildings. The monstrous growths from Babylon to Brasilia are all well documented. What is left out is the ordinary, which is like restricting the science of botany to lilies and roses. Vernacular architecture has never been homogenized. It can never be an international language, for it is rooted in its places and the indigenous materials and patterns of life. Its most disturbing element for the businessman is its. Now I'm at this word again, which I. Longevity? Anyway, longevity, if things last for a long time. And its builders, Rudofsky emphasized, never thought of themselves as professional builders. So Colin, throughout his writing and his teaching, claimed for the architectural profession to basically let people build again on their own terms, within the conditions they set up for themselves. And because Ralph was asking me earlier what he practically did, Colin Ward, as an architect. So for a short period in the 70s, he was an official planner for one of the London boroughs. So he was a kind of a local authority planning officer. And in this short time, he enabled a few self-built projects, which I think those things vary massively from national context to national context. Maybe in the Netherlands, it's completely the people self-built. In Britain, it's very uncommon. So in 1973, they started this self-built scheme in Lewisham using a method called the Walter Siegel self-built method. And again, I don't know if that's familiar here. He's an architect who developed a system for self-built, which is very pragmatic. It's based on the idea that you go to your next DIY shop and buy any sheet material, any bowls, anything. And he made a manual for how to use this to build your own house. And it was meant as a building method for people who have no previous skills and to enable to go and build your own house. And technical terms, it's very successful. It's all about making building something feasible for everyone. So one of Colin's kind of practical achievements was to facilitate and also to push through two bigger self-build initiatives in London and to redirect money from right to buy into build your own house and so on. So he's strongly remembered for this, no, I would say. And the Walter Siegel Trust, which was important, is still going. It's just, I think in a place like London, it stands very little chance. They haven't done any self-build since, because every developer is almost faster to get any tiny piece of land. And the one reason why they could do this particular globe and seemed commercially not viable for commercial developers, which is not the case anymore in London. Across the UK, there's still a lot of self-built, Walter Siegel self-built trusts going, often related to Colin Ward as a theoretician. I quickly read something from The Child in the Country, since we're in the country, and we're all children. And have children. That is from 1988. And that's Colin Ward. 10 years ago, I wrote a book, The Child in the City, about the relationship between urban children and their environment. The book was, to my mind, more a celebration of resourcefulness than a catalogue of deprivations. But when it was discussed at meetings and conferences of teachers and social workers, there was always somebody who would comment that while we had a whole library of studies of the city child, rural childhood was examined only as a historical phenomenon or through rosy nostalgia. Assumptions of the city deprivation were based on an unstated comparison. It was claimed with some ideal country environment. Yet there were many more country children who grew up in conditions of disadvantage and deprivation unnoticed just because of our automatic assumptions about rural life. I don't know how many of you today here come live urban or rural, but the assumptions about what the rural is are sometimes quite shocking. The one occasion in recent history when city and country children were brought face to face with each other, as were their teachers, was in the wartime evacuation. And there's a whole chapter about how literally inner city children were moved to the countryside during the Second World War and clashed, and what clash it was. When I wrote about the child in the city, I became aware that in modern Britain, the distinctions between city, suburb, small town, and village grow less tenable as the years go by. In what sense is the country dweller who commutes to the city and whose children commute to the nearest urban school to be thought of as a villager? Of the child in the Orkney Islands or Anglesey, is the experience of a child in the Orkney Islands anything like that of the child living in the Green Belt or metropolitan city? Oh, that's a nice sentence. One thing that I have learned is that the children of what seem to be remote places are especially anxious to remind you that they do not spend their lives chasing sheep, but follow the same fashions and play the same tapes as their urban counterparts. The lives of rural children scarcely conform our stereotypes. And I think those books are very much about stereotypes and how we ourselves constantly trap into them. Perhaps the most ironical thing is amongst the minority of families where the breadwinners are full-time farm workers, 40% have incomes which fall below the supplementary benefit entitlement level. Farm workers of both sexes are the lowest paid workers in the country. And so on and so on. So a lot of his writing is about pointing out how obviously deprivation in the city and the rural cause similar results, which is low mobility for the children, low access to education, getting out and so on. And there's one then nice comment about the middle classes. However, above a certain social level, parents took it for granted that their children should have both urban and rural experiences, so with a strong bias for the rural. The rich in bringing up their children have always been able to mingle urban and rural experiences. The possession of a townhouse as well as a rural estate, whether we are thinking of Imperial Rome, okay, that's going a bit far back now, but I think we, our society has that still as well, the rural, the townhouse and the rural holiday house. 18th century Britain or 19th century Russia, family game, as well as of the drama of the transition between the two. The country may have been the ideal child-rearing environment for those who had the choice, but all through the 19th century, the drift from the land drew poor community dwellers into the cities and the new industrial towns, out of the economic necessity in a migration as dramatic as the gigantic movements of population into the exploding cities of Africa, Asia, and Latin America today. And in Britain then, just as in the Third World today, if the parents were asked what they hoped to achieve by exchanging rural for urban poverty, they would reply that they had taken this decisive step for the sake of their children's future. Shall I show a few pictures?
Yeah.
I can leave those books here if you want to have a look or read. But
I think it's in the library.
Yeah. But anyone who's interested in architecture and planning, definitely read some of Colin's essays and lectures. And I can leave them here. We actually have some left from yesterday. Yeah.
Are there any questions?
I have a question. I wonder, on one hand, you rural children, children living in a rural place, mentioned that their lives were not so different from their urban counterparts. But on the other hand, you said that the children that were moved from urban place to a more rural place during the Second World War had such a cultural clash. Do you think this is just because of the lack of schooling around them? Or
I think the evacuation, the Second World War evacuation, it was like inner city children coming to small rural communities. And I think back then, rural life for rural children probably had still very different realities, like being involved in kind of farm labor from very early on. I think that has changed. But I think what Colin Ward is trying to make a point is that whenever we think of the countryside, we try to think of those quite old images of the child who's, you know, looking after the sheep, of the kind of healthy, rosy child that grows up in the countryside. And I think he's just trying to make a point that deprivation is quite strong amongst rural communities, and that those images have to go. They have to be put in different comparisons and compared to economic deprivation in cities, rather than being compared to lots of green trees. And we think the children look rosy. They might, but they might not. Yeah.
Maybe the contrast in Britain is bigger than here. I mean, I've seen those villages, whatever, only houses and no green and those things. And it's not so bad over here. And also people or the little children are going to the camping over here. I mean, things have changed.
I mean, of course, we know all that in Britain, land ownership is a very, very different issue, and there's a much bigger, poor rural working class because they were all land laborers. I mean, I'm an artist, and I'm just in my work interested in preconceptions. Like, whenever I say I go to my village to do some work, people are either quite shocked, like, why would you? Yeah, there's nothing. Yeah, there's an assumption that the rural is this cultural desert, like culture has stopped a long time ago. But there's also
then they don't see the value of nature, because they're living in the city.
I know, and I think I'm interested in kind of making connections between both experiences, not just for with people who I'm working with. So if I work in my home village with the women there, I'm quite keen not to teach them what's great about London. I make connections for them to have experiences I value about the city. And it's not about judging one against the other. And I find this just constantly extremely unhelpful if people ask me, oh, what's better, London or your home village? You know, there's no answer to this. I think what interests me in my work is to or images to experiences to have to actually just experience both places rather than going there with a prejudice that then you want to have fulfilled. You know, you move to the countryside with your children because it's healthier, and then you want this to happen because it was your big expectation, without actually looking what's going on in those places. And yeah. And to play with images, it's quite nice. Yesterday for the talk, I had two images of mud hills, and it was up to the audience to say which one is the urban and the rural one. And certain images are just incredibly similar. So, yeah.
Right,
I have one big picture book. And it was maybe, can I show this briefly?
Yeah.
Because actually I find it easier to talk about my artwork sometimes. My villages we did in Berlin last year. And Babke Veenstra is one of the Dutch members of the group. She's from Friesland. And we were invited to organize food for a festival on culture and sustainability. And we were meant to collect this food in and around Berlin. And they asked us, because we're called My Villages and we sound like we can organize something. But of course, our interest was to get quite a broad picture of what food production means for a city. And the project was called Vorratskammer. I think it's a similar word in Dutch, no? Vorratskammer, yeah. So for a year we filled a larder with about 80 co-producers of food in and around Berlin. And there was everything from your community garden, who grows fairly small amounts of food, to quite big farmers, a collective for non-commercial agriculture, to some fishers. What was important for us in the continuously published a lot of images, which also contradicted our ideas of city and growing food. And our images in our heads are often quite limited. The community allotments, like quite friendly communities growing things, or it's then often already the kind of big industrial scale of farming. There seem to be very few in between images. So alongside collecting food for 8,000 people, we also produced a lot of images, which were also questioning and contradicting assumptions about growing food in the city. That's high-tech Dutch lettuce swimming in front of the House of World Cultures in Berlin. And it was a very, very strong image and very intriguing. And then we would have a lot of seminars about the whole technology behind it. Is it actually kind of a sustainable form of growing food in our cities? But at the same time, we would just commission a small brewer to make all the beer, grow a little bit of linseed in front of the venue to make 5 liters of oil, which were gone in one lunch. Yeah, super inefficient. We would host a farmer protest when they came to Berlin, because they would protest at Angela Merkel's, but no one offers them any food. So the pantry was quite equipped to also host people when they demonstrated against food policies. There was a whole discussion about rural and local and organic. Everybody really wanted us to have only organic and only local. And we thought they're a little bit too exclusive as criteria, because they don't allow us to question things anymore once you've labeled things. So we had super local urban pigs, and then we couldn't find an organic slaughterhouse until driving out of Berlin for like 100 kilometers. So those and we know this, that all this craziness is in almost all of our food chains, but they're not talked about it anymore once you have the label local on it. Then everybody's just happy. But then we had a very local cheese made by a Spaniard, and everyone was like, why can't we make German cheese? We're like, live in Berlin? And one of the big local phenomena of Berlin is that you have a hell of a lot of international artists living here. So this cheese is so local, made by a Spanish artist. And then, of course, we collected free goods, had a few wild boars. There's lots of them in Berlin, which can't be organic because they actually eat the rubbish from the people's leftovers, which might not be organic, so then the pig is not organic. Quite complicated. And so on. But that was, in regards to Colin Ward, that was a book which used images a lot to contradict assumptions and expectations about the rural or the urban. And now I stop. Yeah, I leave it here.
Is it on the internet as well?
Yeah, there's a logbook, like the 12 months we collected food. That's kind of a blog, an ongoing blog. The book is not online. No.
But the information, what's the website?
It's vorratskammer.net. If you go, it's myvillages.org, and then there's a link to the project.
Okay.
Yeah.
know his eye. His mother cries, she knows that he is strong enough to die. He's rolling in the kettle like his midnight sun roof is down. Three shots right out of here, I'm dead. The new king is crowned.
Black or white shoes, black head killer.
Yeah, the poison time bomb.
We got more coming right now. There's more coming. We're gonna get a little sort of a session going here. A bit of a session. A session that will feature the rhythm section.
The way I walk is just the way I walk. The way I talk is just makes me spit it back and I go, oh, 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 oh. The way I love is just the way I love. Come on and be the one I'm thinking of. Touch me, baby, oh, it feels so good. Sometimes I think I wanna, but I don't wanna whip it much at all. Baby, back and I'm going to go, oh, 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 oh.
Thank you. Peter, dankjewel. En nou, Dennis gaat zometeen iets vertellen over de commune van Parijs. En wij willen met, samen met Maartje even iets, onze brochure eigenlijk presenteren. We hebben een brochure geschreven met onze leesclub. Onze leesclub heet Petroleuses. En wij hebben een brochure en onderzoek gedaan naar een rol van de vrouwen tijdens de Parijscommune. Dus Maartje gaat iets vertellen over onze leesclub en dan ik ga iets kort vertellen over de brochure.
Met microfoon.
Ja.
Dat
hoeft niet.
Oké. Hallo. Ja, ik wilde heel kort iets vertellen over onze leesclub. We zijn met 5 mensen en Agnes is er ook, toch? Agnes,
ja.
Daar. En Emmy en Erlin. En sinds 2,5 jaar lezen we samen boeken en brochures. En we dachten dat het leuk zou zijn. We hebben best wel veel gelezen over de Commune van Parijs. André heeft wat boeken meegenomen. En we dachten dat het leuk zou zijn om daar iets meer mee te doen dan alleen maar zelf te lezen en met elkaar te praten over wat we hebben gelezen en wat we daarvan vonden. Dus daarom hebben we een brochure geschreven en Andrea zal iets meer vertellen over wat erin staat.
Zo. Oké, dus we hebben deze. We hebben als eerste boek hebben we deze boek gelezen van Edith Thomas, de Women Incendiaries. Het is een hele leuke boek. En dan andere boeken die we hebben een beetje gelezen is deze. En deze is allemaal te koop bij de Fort van Chaco. Maar Oké, ik over de brochure. Nou, we hebben gewoon heel veel plezier om te gaan over dat we hebben gewoon geschreven. En we hebben het gewoon verdeeld in een paar hoofdstukken. De eerste hoofdstuk gaat heel kort over de Parijse Commune, maar daar gaat Dennis meer over vertellen. Over de anarchisten en Parijse Commune. Bijvoorbeeld, wat hebben de anarchisten toen de tijd over de Parijse Commune geschreven? Of waren de communards überhaupt anarchisten? Dan is er ook een hoofdstuk over de vrouwen en de commune. Nou, over de rol van de vrouwen en ook over de positieve verbeelding en negatieve verbeelding. En vooral die negatieve verbeelding die is heel erg, maar dat kunnen jullie ook even kort lezen. En dan 2 hoofdstukken, het feministische socialisme van de commune van Parijs. In deze hoofdstuk hebben we geschreven over wat hebben eigenlijk deze vrouwen gedaan. En bijvoorbeeld over hun vrouwelijke vakbond Union de Femmes. Over de politieke clubs waar ze ook heel erg actief waren. En ook heel radicaal en heel militant. Want eigenlijk de vrouwen die wilden eigenlijk samen een soort bataljon vochten. Zodat ze samen met mannen kunnen vochten. Maar dat was hun niet toegekend omdat, nou ja, waren gewoon vrouwen en de vrouwen horen niet in het leger. Nou ja, een hele korte hoofdstuk over de Louis Michel. Meest bekende communards van de Parijs Commune. En de laatste hoofdstuk hebben we een hele discussie over gehad. Want het gaat eigenlijk over de rol van de vrouwen in de revoluties voor de commune van Parijs. En persoonlijk vond ik het gewoon heel belangrijk om te in te lezen. Want natuurlijk, de rol van de vrouwen tijdens de Parijs Commune kwam niet zomaar. En er is een hele grote traditie. En die traditie is eigenlijk begonnen bij de Franse Revolutie van 1789. En nou, ik heb gewoon onderzoek naar gedaan. En dat waar het eigenlijk min of meer is begonnen. Dus dat is gewoon begonnen bij de 1789. En ik heb eigenlijk ook over onderzoek naar gedaan over de revoluties van 1830 en 1848. Omdat er daar ook een soort lijn trekt naar de Parijs Commune. En de rol, de radicaliteit, de vrouwen die steeds radicaler worden. Dus dat vonden we heel belangrijk om in een brochure op te nemen. Zodat mensen het ook begrijpen dat het commune niet, de vrouwen die actief waren in de commune, die niet zomaar ontstonden tijdens de commune. Maar dat die traditie die bestond al. En ook de radicaliteit werd steeds groter en groter bij de vrouwen. Dus ik hoop dat jullie dit brochure leuk vinden. En we hebben ook een e-mail aangemaakt. De e-mailadres staat erin. Dus als er opmerkingen zijn, verbeteringen zijn, graag horen wij dat. En
ja, dat wilde ik nog zeggen.
Oh ja, nou dus ja, volgens mij Ja, natuurlijk. Bij de Ford van Chaco. €2 kost het. Ja, dus ja, moeten we nog iets zeggen? Nee. Nou, wij geven heel snel de woord aan Dennis, want die heeft veel meer te vertellen.
Dankjewel. Ik ga me eventjes hierin hangen. Dan... Tenminste, als dat werkt. Ja. Zo beter? Nee. Nog niet.
Spreek je me?
Ja, dankjewel. Nou, dan heb ik wat handen vrij voor mijn papiertjes. Ik ga het hebben over de Commune van Parijs. En dat mag ik hier doen omdat ik later dit jaar een boek hoop te publiceren over de Commune van Parijs. Dat ligt nu bij de uitgever. En de uitgever die meldde al dat hij over de omvang wilde praten. Ik vrees dat hij het dunner wil, maar je kan niet uitsluiten dat hij misschien nog weer wat dikker. Dat boek gaat over de Commune van Parijs, tenminste de Commune van Parijs, de bloedige barricade. Dat is de hoofdtitel, maar eigenlijk gaat het niet over de Commune, maar gaat het over de manier waarop latere socialisten de Commune herdacht hebben, de herdenkingscultuur rondom de Commune. Die geschiedenis zelf staat in mijn boek dus niet centraal, ik kom daar wel op terug. Maar vooral de mythologie, de manier waarop latere socialisten, en dan bedoel ik sociaaldemocraten, communisten en zeker ook anarchisten, de manier waarop die latere socialisten zijn omgegaan met die erfenis van de Commune. En dat begint dus op de dag na de Commune. Dan na de nederlaag begint het herdenken. En dat is interessant omdat die socialisten van al die verschillende schakeringen niet alleen die Commune herdenken, maar ook proberen daar lessen uit te trekken. Nieuwe strategieën proberen te ontwikkelen. En dat is dus het eigenlijke onderwerp van mijn boek. Ik heb het dus over het socialisme als geheel. In het boek laat ik wel zien wat de grote verschillen zijn. Ik doe dat